Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge, the show where nothing is off topic. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here with you for mini episode number 277. We have a great conversation for you today, and really, kind of just shows what a small world it is having this gentleman on. We've been looking forward to doing this for some time, but have some indirect ties to him already. Our good friend and frequent co-host on these programs, Russ Cohen, hopefully will be able to join us at some point today. He is a little bit busy with the NHL draft preparation, but this gentleman that we have with us today worked with Russ, wrote the foreword for the great book, 100 Ranger Greats, which you've heard us promote endlessly on the program here, a truly, truly great book of hockey, and it was a tremendous addition to the book to have the foreword by this gentleman. He also holds down the same job as four-time FDH Lounge guest Kenny Albert, that being NFL play-by-play broadcaster for Fox Sports. Additionally, they both cover the New York Rangers hockey team as well. Given that he has a long background covering the NHL beat as a whole with NHL radio in subsequent years, having games, playoff games on the NBC Sports Network, we will be talking probably predominantly with him, at least at the outset, about the just-completed Stanley Cup Final, his thoughts on the season, and what a strange season it was, compressed as it was after the labor stoppage prior to the season. But it is a pleasure to have on the program one of the truly great voices in American sports broadcasting, Sam Rosen. Sam, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you on today, sir.
I mean, that was just fabulous, and it's a pleasure to be on with you. I hope everybody enjoyed the playoffs, and we're getting into summertime, but there's still a lot of activity. We've got a draft coming up, and the next week free agency starts, so there's still a lot of fun to be had as far as the hockey world is concerned.
Oh, there certainly is. There's no question about that, and as you said, not just the draft, but free agency. I want to touch on a little bit of that with you as well. Looking back at the playoffs, of course, you were probably paying closest attention to the two teams in the final when the Bruins were playing the New York Rangers, of course, a matchup of original six teams that foreshadowed the Stanley Cup final, where it was Boston and Chicago. But it's very, very funny because when we did the final preview on the show, myself and my good friend Russ Cohen were split on this. He correctly forecast that Chicago would win. I thought after just looking at that complete and utter blitzkrieg in the Eastern Conference, or at least after Boston dispensed of Toronto, which it was very fitful for them to do, but I didn't think there was any stopping the Bruins. I didn't think there was any stopping the clampdown style that they had, and they kind of started out that way through the first three games, not so much through the last three. What did you think going in, Sam, based on your experience of having seen Boston, what they did with the Rangers and throughout the Eastern Conference playoffs, and how did it stack up to what actually happened?
Well, I'll take you back to the regular season and the way Chicago started their regular season with 24 games in which they did not lose a game in regulation time. They had a tremendous start going halfway through the 48-game lockout shortened season. I thought they showed great consistency all season long. I thought they had all the component parts to go all the way, and certainly winning the President's Trophy was a big notch for them. I had a chat with my good friend Eddie Olczyk of NBC, who also does the Blackhawks color commentary throughout the season, and he felt that he was concerned that they weren't physical enough. I think the one concern I had was Chicago against L.A., and Chicago found a way to get through and get themselves to the Stanley Cup final. So I like the Blackhawks going in. I like their team. I like the balance that they had. The experience of several of those players having been there 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, four seasons back. They've won two in the last four seasons. I think that really held them in good stead. Now, that said, Boston certainly was tough, physical, but Boston, I think some of the injuries caught up with them, and they played hurt. Losing Gregory Campbell was a big factor. I think you can't underestimate how big a role player he is on that Bruins team. He was part of their championship team 2 years ago. So I liked Chicago going all the way, and I stayed with them. I thought, quite honestly, that Boston would win Game 6, and Chicago would win Game 7 at home. And Chicago had their miracle turnaround in the last minute and 20 seconds of Game 6 to turn that game around. So I thought overall the playoffs were great. The Stanley Cup Final Series was fantastic. They played the triple overtime game. You had other overtime games. It was a great matchup, great series, played by Warriors out there, and Chicago prevailed, and they deserved to win that series.
I give you great credit, Sam, because I picked Chicago before the season. I picked Chicago before the outset of the playoffs, and then when it came time for the final, I flinched. I thought Boston would. I thought they would beat them based on just how they completely and utterly decimated the Penguins. Yeah. So I give you credit for sticking with that. It's interesting.
As I said, Rick, the one hesitation I had, Rick, quite honestly, was after I talked to Eddie Olczyk, and he said, Sam, I don't think they're physical enough. I don't think they can handle a pounding from L.A. And if they get to the conference final and that's the matchup, I think they'll get worn down. I don't know if they can stand up to that pounding. And they found a way. And full credit to their stars, Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane and Marian Hossa, but also Corey Crawford really stepped up and was big time in goal despite that. The 1-6-5 game, he still answered the call with some great goaltending when they needed it.
Sam, you brilliantly anticipated my next point here, because I was just about to say about Corey Crawford, what he kind of puts me in mind of, at least as far as the regard, not necessarily his game, but how he's regarded. I, too, am a fan of an original 16, in my case, the Detroit Red Wings. I always felt that Chris Osgood really took a lot more abuse, really was kind of underrated over a period of time. Came within one game back in 2009 of being a three-time Stanley Cup winner in net. So you had Crawford coming into the series, who had already won a Stanley Cup. Tuukka Rask, regarded by most as the better goaltender overall, at least after the kind of year that he had. And yet Corey Crawford is a two-time Cup winner as a starter. Does he kind of remind you of the same way?
I've got to disagree with you there, Rick. I've got to correct you on that. The one they won four seasons back, Antti Niemi was the goaltender for the Blackhawks. So it was Niemi who was the starter in the first of their two, and Niemi, of course, went on to sign with San Jose and has played well for them, but it was Antti Niemi at the time, and I think the big question that the Blackhawks had was Corey Crawford ready to step up and take over as the number one? He and Ray Emery split duties all season long. Emery had a great year. I think he went like 15-1, but Corey Crawford got the starting nod come playoff time, and he stepped up and lived up to being a number one goaltender in the playoffs. But the first cup belongs to Antti Niemi, the second one to Corey Crawford.
Yes, great point. And nevertheless, on the overall point as far as regard for goalies, does it kind of remind you of a little bit of the same thing? Sometimes a team will win the cup and the goalie is not necessarily an afterthought, but certainly not the first thing you look at. In the case of the Blackhawks, they have, as you said, Toews and Kane, and you keep going down the line. You look at the blue line with Keith and Seabrook and everyone else. It takes you a while before you really kind of focus on Corey Crawford. So in that way, it kind of reminded me of Chris Osgood, if not the multiple Stanley Cups yet, although they certainly look like they're on pace for that in the next couple of years. So what are your thoughts on him and what this is likely to do for his career at this point?
Well, I agree with what you said. Your premise is right on, Rick. Look at the man who won the Conn Smythe Trophy as the MVP of the playoffs, and that was Patrick Kane. And yet Kane didn't have a great – I wouldn't say he stood out as the best player to me. He certainly came up big in key situations, scored a lot of big goals. So did Jonathan Toews. I thought Corey Crawford deserved to be the Conn Smythe Trophy winner just based on the way he played those big games, the overtime games, the way he came through. I just think he answered the call of a big-time goaltender when they needed it. And I think as far as his career is concerned, it puts him on a plateau, you know, for a goaltender to have played every single game, to win the 16 games in the toughest run in the playoffs to win a championship, as far as I'm concerned, and to do it with really good numbers outside of that 6-5 game, which he wound up winning, his goals against were in the low twos. He did a terrific job. He came up with big performances, clutch performances. So, I think Corey Crawford has really moved up a notch in the realm of goaltenders around the NHL, and now he's got to build off of that. He can establish himself as one of the top goalies in the league with the way he played in regular season and, of course, in winning the Stanley Cup.
Well, something I'd like to ask you about, Sam, with your background on having broadcast the finals as many times as you have, Russ Cullen and I were talking about this when we did our preview for the finals here, and both agreeing that it was a really cool feel to it as you were building to the final this year when you had the last four Stanley Cup champions that were in there. If you look chronologically, the last five, because my Red Wings were the last team to get eliminated in the conference semifinals, but this felt like the first time that we felt this really since the heyday of my Red Wings, Colorado, Dallas, New Jersey. You had them in there seemingly every year, some combo of those teams getting ready to stand at the end. Were you getting that feel for the first time since then with all of these teams in there that these are sort of the dominant teams of this era and they're stepping up and getting ready to make repeat runs?
Well, certainly when you see when you talk about your Red Wings, Rick, the consistency that they have shown over the last two decades is just amazing. I mean, they've been great champions. They've won multiple championships, and the years where they don't win, they're right there battling, getting into the playoffs and battling deep into the playoffs most of the time. They've been a great, great, proud franchise down through the years, and they're retooling now. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year, but certainly Jimmy Howard becomes the foundation of the future of the Detroit Red Wings. But that said, the teams that won that you mentioned, with the Boston Bruins having a chance to have made it two cups in 3 years, but coming up one game short, that says a lot for the way the Bruins have put together their team. The Blackhawks right there making the playoffs, winning two championships over the last 4 years. It says a lot, but I would say this. I don't think you can exclude a lot of other teams. The LA Kings, who, as you mentioned, they get to the conference final. They win last year. This is a team that looks like they'll be around for a long time to come, young goaltender. The team that I follow, the New York Rangers, though they didn't take that last step last season, they got knocked out in the conference final by the Devils, they certainly feel and believe that they can be a contender each year. They got knocked out in the second round of the playoffs this year, but they feel they have a competitive team. The New Jersey Devils, we'll see how they bounce back. Last year they got to the Stanley Cup Finals, losing to L.A. This year was a tough year for them, but the Devils have great organization. They've got to just find a way to bounce back from Zach Parise leaving them. But I don't think we'll see one or two dominant teams, but I think we'll see a lot of good teams. These teams are very close. You look at what happened, you know, you mentioned the Boston Bruins. In round one, they were a breath away from being eliminated. And what would have happened had Toronto held on and won Game 7 of that first-round series? What would have happened in Boston? Would they have been calling for Claude Julien's head? Would they have been saying, oh, we've got to make changes now? Some of our guys don't come up big when we need them. It would have been a very interesting scenario. That said, they rally, they have the miracle finish, they win Game 7 in overtime, and they wind up going six games deep into the Stanley Cup Finals. So these teams are very close. A lot of good teams that with maybe one or two changes can be right there knocking on the door next season.
Well, vis-a-vis the fine line, Sam, between success and failure, I can assure you I have very painful memories of how close Chicago came to getting knocked out in the second round of the playoffs.
There you go.
That was
the Red Wings up
well.
3-1 in that series, sure.
Yes, yes, and couldn't sustain it in the end. As far as it goes, talking about your Rangers, it's a very unique moment, it seems like, in the history of the franchise now. Not merely with John Tortorella going away and a new coach coming in, Mark Messier departing the organization. It seems like a lot of things flying around here. A year away from Henrik Lundqvist, who, in my estimation, has grabbed the mantle as being the definitive best goalie in the game today. Albeit, you don't often say that about somebody who doesn't have a Stanley Cup. Martin Brodeur, Patrick Roy had each won the cup by the time we said it about them. But Lundqvist has not won that yet, and perhaps that's weighing on his mind a year from now with decisions looming for free agency. So what are your thoughts about the new regime coming in and the makeup of this team next year, which, as you had pointed out, does have some very interesting young parts to it?
Yeah, there are a lot of pluses on the team. I think they've put together some really good talent. You start with Henrik Lundqvist, and Glenn Sather has already laid the groundwork for negotiations on a contract extension and a long-term contract extension for Henrik Lundqvist. I think a red flag went up when at the end of the season when he was asked about it, and Lundqvist did not commit right away. People started to say, uh-oh, there's got to be a problem here, and you know, what are the Rangers going to do about it? And the end result was they changed their coaching staff. So it should be very interesting. I think they made a very, very good choice in Alain Vigneault as a man with tremendous experience, 11 years as a head coach in the NHL. He's had good success with two President's Trophies in regular season with Vancouver, getting to Game 7 against the Boston Bruins 2 years ago in the Stanley Cup Final. So this is a man who comes at it with a different approach, a more calm approach than John Tortorella. I think that will serve him well. He's got some good young talent that he's going to work to develop. On defense, you have players like Ryan McDonagh. Hopefully Mark Stahl will be healthy and 100%. They're hoping that Michael Delzato will continue to develop. They've drafted on defense and hope they can add to their defensive core. So that gives them a solid base. And then, of course, bringing in the players that they did, Rick Nash, they want to build their offense around him. I think Derek Brassard, who came over in the big trade with Columbus, showed that he's got really good offensive skill. They've got a gritty and gutty leader in Ryan Callahan as their captain, a terrific all-around player, and a young player like Derek Stepan stepped up and showed he could be a number one centerman. So they've got the foundation. They've got the makings of a really good team. They'll have to add to that. But I think they felt that a change in style and a change in philosophy would do them well. And they're looking to let players like Rick Nash just go full bore and score goals and be the offensive leader that they were hoping to get when they made the deal with Columbus.
Absolutely, and there is somebody who's been in the news the last couple of days who is tied in the history books to John Tortorella and to Brad Richards. That, of course, being Vincent LeCavalier, who the three of them together hoisting the Stanley Cup back in 2004. Kind of a surprise, or maybe not, given the cap situation that Tampa Bay has got. Certainly would have been a surprise a couple of years ago to figure that he would have been a cap casualty, and back when it was being bandied about that perhaps Montreal might trade for him. In the end, Tampa Bay ends up eating a good amount on that contract, and he becomes one of the more intriguing names on the market come Monday. What are your thoughts on the free agency period? Because it looked like it was going to be fairly thinned overall, but all of a sudden you put a name like that in the mix, and it does seem like it gets that much more interesting.
Yeah, it changes a little bit, but I will say this. I mean, Vinny's been a great player, has had a terrific career, and a guy who's a great, great component of their Stanley Cup championship in 2004. But I think Vinny slowed down a little bit. So before anybody rushes out and signs him, I think they've got to take a look at what kind of player they're getting. It may not be that that guy who would have the end-to-end rushes and the big finish and the great scoring ability. Maybe more of an all-around center who will score a little bit less. Tampa Bay now becomes Steven Stamkos' team. He's the guy in the face of the franchise and the big scorer, the man who will make a run at the Art Ross Trophy every year, and a terrific player who works so hard. But Vinny will definitely draw interest. He's a talented player, but I think teams have to be careful. You're not getting the Vinny LeCavalier of 9 years ago. I think you're getting a different version, just a little bit of a slowed down version, and you've got to be careful. And Tampa Bay, as many teams are facing, made the decision to use their buyout. The Rangers, you mentioned Brad Richards, that's certainly a big decision coming up for the Rangers. They right now are about $13 or $14 million under the salary cap, which is good, coming down this year, but they have some restricted free agents to sign, and Ryan McDonagh, Derek Stepan, Carl Hagelin. They've got to get those younger players signed. And financially, if it makes more sense to buy out Brad Richards, they might go that way. But they're not a deep team at center, so I think the Rangers may wind up giving Brad Richards another year, especially under a new coach. So it'll be interesting to see what moves teams make based on the salary cap and who becomes available in free agency next week. Overall, I don't think you're seeing guys that will really make over teams. I think you'll see a lot of good role players, second and third line guys, but I don't know if you'll see that that one or a couple of significant players that can turn a team totally around.
Well, hearing you describe, Sam, and I agree with you that I think Vincent LeCavalier is certainly slowed a bit from his prime. It makes me want to ask you about this when we're talking about a teammate of his. There was a slight, it would be, I guess, an overstatement to say disagreement on this, but Russ Cohen and I previously on the show and talking about Marty St. Louis, I said I thought that he was probably going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, particularly given that part of his career was in the clutch and grab days of the league, and he was successful even before things opened up after the 2005 lockout. Russ, a little bit more dubious on that, but when you look at his late career resurgence, what he did this year, what are your thoughts on Marty St. Louis' place in history?
I think he's definitely a Hall of Famer. You never know about first ballots and how guys vote, but he definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He's had a marvelous career for a player who went undrafted, a player who was thought to be too small to make it in the NHL. He's had a great career, has proved himself to be a leader, big-time scorer, Stanley Cup champion, MVP. You can't say enough about what Marty St. Louis has accomplished and continues to play at a high level. When they need a player to come up big when they need a combination, whether it was Marty to help Vinny LeCavalier or Marty to help Steven Stamkos or Marty to work with Brad Richards when Brad was still in Tampa Bay. He was always there, and he was always the big-time player. As determined and motivated a player as there has ever been in the NHL, and he certainly will be in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the great players in my mind who really, you talk about overachievers, he's the epitome of the overachiever.
Could not agree more. He has done so much with what he has. Wanted to bring it around, Sam, by asking you a little bit about the NFL and your thoughts looking ahead to this year. But before I do, speaking of football, I know from your bio, you've covered a different kind, and it's one that I've gotten to be intrigued with, again, in the last couple of years, that being Australian rules football. my team of choice, the Western Bulldogs, wasn't even that when you were covering them. Now, they were Footscray back at that time. But I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that as far as its place in Australian society. I know that rugby's big over there as well. So maybe there's not an exact analogous situation of that to the popularity of American football, but every indication that I get following it from afar is that it is pretty huge over there and pretty central in the sports life of that country. How big is it exactly over there?
Well, you know what? I can't put myself in the expert's role here of defining how big it is. The times that I covered it, quite honestly, was in the early days of ESPN, when they were looking for programming, and Australian rules football was very, very popular. And this is going back to the early 80s, and we used to do it from the studio. We covered it from the studio, got the feed in, but you could see the crowd enthusiasm, the excitement for the game, the physical nature of the game. Tremendous sport in Australia, and I believe it's still it is still very, very popular. You mentioned rugby. Rugby certainly is popular there. But I would say Australian rules football maintains a level of popularity and has for many, many years there. It was just, for me, it was really fun doing something different, albeit doing it from the studio. But as you said, watching it from afar and just noticing the involvement of the players and the physical nature of the game, just as rugby is so physical, so is Australian rules football, and creates a tremendous amount of excitement down in Australia.
I love it. And unfortunately, my Western Bulldogs these days are about as downtrodden as my Cleveland Browns. So turning it on that note to the NFL, and of course you don't see that much of them in as much as you're covering the NFC, but to me, this is just my sense. The NFC seems like where the action is, not merely in terms of the number of recent Super Bowls won, not this past year, but when you've had the Giants and the Packers and teams like that. But my early sense is if you're going to find a rivalry of the 2010s, that it might very well be San Francisco and Seattle. They seem to be positioning themselves almost kind of to be like that Colts and Patriots thing from the last decade. What's your sense of the dynamic out there, and if it could be the defining one of this decade?
A pretty good analogy, Rick. I think when you look at what's happened, you talk about a turnaround. The NFC West, you mentioned the word downtrodden. I think the NFC West had been down for a lot of years, and suddenly, even though you go back to the fact that Arizona, although they were a 9-17 that year, had a great run and got to the Super Bowl, and then wound up losing to Pittsburgh. But I think the NFC West has really come on, and I would imagine a lot of that has to do with finishing low. You wind up drafting high, and eventually, if you draft well, you get the good personnel in there, you're good in free agency, you turn your franchise around. 49ers have been just great the last 2 years, and I had a friend of mine, a former hockey player, Chris Katsopoulos, who was a big 49ers fan. He feels that the 49ers were robbed in the Super Bowl. How could they have taken that away from them? He felt there was a conspiracy to deny the 49ers and allow Baltimore to win the Super Bowl. But 49ers, Seattle has come on under Pete Carroll the last couple of years. You're seeing the St. Louis Rams start to get better. They've drafted well. If Sam Bradford can step up and become that elite-type quarterback, that will be another strong team in the NFC West. Jeff Fisher is an excellent coach, and he's certainly got the Rams going on the right way. They've drafted some strong defensive players. So, yeah, when you look at the NFC West, it's a better division than ever. And you mentioned the fact of the rivalry between the 49ers and Seattle. Well, you've got the rivalry of the coaches, Pete Carroll and Jim Harbaugh, and then the rivalry of the quarterbacks, Colin Kaepernick stepping up, and Russell Wilson. There's a lot of good things going on in that division, and certainly when you look right at the top with the way the 49ers are in Seattle coming on, it lends itself to a strong rivalry.
I must agree with your friend, Sam, albeit as a Browns fan, I'm not exactly unbiased on the notion of Baltimore having stolen the Super Bowl, so I can't quite be unbiased on that, but I would agree that San Francisco was robbed. Well, what's interesting also, too, and talking about it with the Rangers before, another team that I know that you're very familiar with up close, it's kind of a hinge moment in history for the Chicago Bears, isn't it? The end of the Lovie Smith era, Mark Trustman comes down there. Some thoughts as to how that's going to fit, particularly with Jay Cutler. I was really curious to see last year, not merely with Brandon Marshall, but with Alshon Jeffrey as well in the vertical game here, too. So what's your sense of how it's all going to fit together this year under Trustman?
Well, similar to the Rangers changing their style, going from a coach who was defensive-oriented to a coach that's offensive-minded, I think you're seeing that in the Chicago Bears. Lovie Smith was always a defense first. Defense has always been the face of the franchise for the Chicago Bears. But now, by bringing in Mark Trestman, this is a man with offensive credentials, an offensive background. He's been a strong offensive coordinator, a terrific coach up in the Canadian Football League. He's brought in because they're pointing towards offense. You're looking at Jay Cutler, a franchise quarterback that they've hooked their wagon to, and this is a guy with one of the strongest arms in the league. And you know, if you protect him, and that's going to be the key this year, he has the potential to be as good as anybody out there. They brought in Brandon Marshall. He had a record-setting season for the Bears. You mentioned Alshon Jeffrey. Matt Forte is an outstanding running back. They've got Michael Bush behind him. They've drafted for the tight end position. They signed Martellus Bennett from the Giants. Former Dallas Cowboy, had a real good year with the Giants last year. He's going to be their number one tight end. So they have put a lot of focus on their offense. Certainly they'll have to retool on defense and get past the loss of Brian Urlacher. That will be certainly changed, but Lance Briggs is still there. Julius Peppers is still there. So the Bears are still a strong team, a team that has potential to make the playoffs and maybe go deep in the playoffs if they can put it all together. They've got the makings of a real solid team, but that said, the NFC Central with Green Bay and Minnesota and an improved Detroit Lions team. You know, we mentioned the NFC West. The NFC Central is tough and bruising as ever. So it'll be good. It'll be a great division battle there. I think the Bears have the potential to be strong. They've got to make sure that the offensive line is put together well and protects Jay Cutler.
Absolutely. And as far as it goes with the NFL, how it's made strides into becoming now almost a year-round obsession in this country, how they've tried to be front and center on the sports calendar all 12 months, As soon as the schedule gets released, almost immediately Vegas will have week one odds and everything like that. I'm curious if it dribbles down to the network level. Have you known for some time where you're going to be week one, or is that going to come later in the summer?
That's going to come in a little while. We've got our Fox seminar coming up at the beginning of August, but they'll probably give us sometime in the middle of July. I think they'll give us the first few weeks of the season, if not the first half of the season. Probably, I would say, the first five or six games, because basically what happens is you don't want to get too far ahead, because as teams get out of the gate and you get strong teams, somebody is surprisingly good, and it's a good marketplace. You want to showcase them as your number one or number two game. So you don't want to go too far in advance, but yet you want to let everybody know where they're going, at least the first month of the season, and then maybe a little beyond that.
Well, I always look forward, Sam, in my hometown of Cleveland, when we get the NFC games here. We always manage to get a couple of them every year with you, and I always look forward to that, and certainly will more so, even now that we've had you on the program. It was, as I knew it would be, sir, a true pleasure talking to you. We'd love to do it again sometime.
Right, I'll look forward to it. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Sam, and thank you all for tuning in. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 277.